We saw in each other exactly what the other needed, that we could intuit it without words, without anything other than being in the other's presence. Now, who knows what Ben needs? Not me, because he won't let me see him, because he doesn't try to see me. I tell myself that maybe I brought this on us, like he senses that I deceived him with Leo, and this is my just reward. I pull my hand away from him now, rest it back in my lap. Maybe I deserve his coolness. I could have done better by him, could have told him the truth, even if he's not aware of my deception. Maybe he is, in the way that we always understood each other. Maybe now he knows, without even knowing it, that I have done him wrong.
I seem to remember that I reminded you about 10 times to fill up the tank, he says as we curve around a bend.
But if we had, I'd never have given you such a perfect story for the script you'll write for me one day. My voice is too light. I can hear myself trying too hard. I see something clench in his jaw. This is a sticking point between us. How many times I've asked, how many times he's deflected. I probably should have just let it rest since we're trapped in a car together until we reach McDonald's or wherever we pull off because Joey can't take it for another second. Ben dropped out of Code Emergency in the spring, despite its huge ratings for Fox, despite its multi-year pickup, which was almost unprecedented. He didn't want to write some bullshit hospital garbage, he said. He didn't want to waste the best years of his life on fucking shitty TV. I'd said fine. I'd said do whatever you have to in order to be happy. But Ben was like a weather vane on a windy day, spinning back and forth with no direction at all, no idea whatsoever what would make him happy. So I'd propose writing something for me, and unlike when we used to banter about how it could be our something great we'd do together, now he just tells me that he doesn't want to ride on my coattails, that he doesn't want people to think that I'm the only reason the project had wings. If I argue, he'll remind me that I once said the very same thing to him back in my early years, and then he usually leaves the room to pour himself a drink. So now he's not writing. He's not doing much of anything that I'm aware of. Are you thinking of sending Reagan back out again? I asked one night a few weeks ago while we were in bed, each reading our own material. Him, yet another book recounting the Reagan-Bush years. Me, the Roe v. Wade script I was highlighting and annotating for prep work.
No one wants it.
He shrugged, his eyes not leaving the page.
Spencer said that. It's dead, for fuck's sake, Ben. It's fucking dead.
Maybe this new bio will give you fresh material, a new angle? He stopped then and looked at me.
It's dead, Tatum, okay? Let it go.
I wanted to say, I have, but what about you? But we don't have these discussions anymore. Not when my suggestions seem like an affront to him. Not when my success has outpaced his to the point where neither one of us can ignore it. I've never thought that Ben has begrudged my ambition, but maybe he's begrudged how I have gotten lucky when he hasn't, when each of us worked as hard as the other, and yet I was the one who got the accolades in the end. I was the one who has been anointed with the Oscar. I don't say this to minimize my acclaim, but luck is some of it, to be sure, and in that respect, surprisingly, after so many years of a bad streak, mine broke the other way. Ben's did not. But rather than spiral into another argument, I eased out from under the duvet to check on Joey, then to email my assistant about my schedule for the next day, whom I had to meet for lunch, whom I had to email, and in what order of importance, where I could steal time to shop online for new school clothes for Joey. I still like to maintain some sense of normalcy, be a mom like every other mom preparing for her child to start pre-K. And then, because we can all be our worst enemies, I'd Google my name and remind myself of all the things that people hated about me, and all the rumors that were nothing more than fiction, but flamed my cheeks and accelerated my pulse all the same. You'd think I'd have more armor now, less insecurity. Sometimes I do. Sometimes, though, because my vulnerability is a requirement for my craft, I'm exactly who I was at 16, with my drunk father and sick mother and lonely nights working the register at the pharmacy. On the web, There were rumors of me engaged in a texting romance with Colin Farrell, whom I viscerally loathed when we worked together on Pride and Prejudice. Rumors of Ben canoodling with an ex-girlfriend. I lingered on that one for more than a beat. But though Ben may have been discontent over the past year, his middling career, the catastrophe with Leo, he wasn't disloyal. Also, it wasn't like he had the energy or the will to canoodle anyway. I clicked the X on the tab and forgot about it. Another made-up story about a life that had nothing to do with mine. I sat in the darkness of my office, illuminated by the glow of my desktop, and told myself to go talk to him. Go tell him that I understood that Reagan was really a love letter to his dad. I understood that Reagan had been Paul's hero, that Paul had a signed, framed letter from the president expressing admiration of a case that he had won, and that the signed, framed letter was now collecting dust in Ben's own office. I understood that Ben couldn't move past this script until he moved past the fact that he wasn't going to bring the film to life, and that his dad really had no ownership over him, especially a decade after he died. But none of this felt kind to say to Ben now. Maybe before Leo I'd have spoken up, told him that he wasn't any type of failure, not to his dad, not to me. But now I simply slipped out of bed to hide in my own office. My own secret built a wall between us, and only in my honesty, telling him that he couldn't have known about Leo because Leo worked so hard to deceive him, would I free him. But then I also knew that my honesty would undo us. He wouldn't forgive me, just as he hadn't forgiven himself. Today, in the car in the canyons of Arizona, Joey is still whimpering, so I pass him a coloring book and crayons, urging him to hold the crayon as I've taught him, as Constance has shown him. He grabs at it with his full fist and scribbles. "The school isn't going to be happy," I sigh, turning back to Ben. "He's still going to need OT. He snorts, shakes his head.
"Our not even 5-year-old is in therapy because he doesn't hold his crayon properly. Welcome to L.A., man."
"Well, I mean, breaking that arm didn't help. Set him back, those muscles all regressing." I stare ahead at the wide expanse of rock ahead. "I'll just tell them that. Say he was in a cast for 2 months.
"Tatum,"
Ben says.
"Seriously, who gives a fuck?"
I glance to Joey, who is wrapped in his coloring and hasn't picked up on Ben's use of fuck, which I have repeatedly implored him to tamp down on in front of the baby, as Joey is prone to repeating it at the top of his voice in the most public of places, which leads to excellent tabloid fodder. What sort of mom is Tatum Connolly? Her son yells fuck in Gelson's. But Ben has said it intentionally, to pick a fight, and though I feel myself bristle at his churlishness, I don't want to take his bait. I want to cruise around the winding corners of the Arizona landscape and remember how we tucked ourselves under the blankets in the back seat of our SUV and watched all the stars light up the blackened sky, and that he promised, one day, he'd write about it for me. I look at Ben, and he sighs remorsefully. We're not so disconnected, he and I. Not yet. Not ever.
"I'm sorry,"
he says.
"I don't mean to take it out on you."
"I know," I say. I reach over and squeeze his shoulder, let my hand linger there, as if I can heal him with my touch. He doesn't pull back this time, rather angles his head closer to me. I smile and breathe that in.
"That was a nice night,"
he says,
"when you were so stubborn that we ran out of gas."
I laugh, and it feels good in my belly. Feels like it echoes and reverberates all the way to my soul.
"Jojo,"
Ben says, looking in the rearview mirror.
"Let's go find a McDonald's. You want a Happy Meal?"
"Daddy," he exclaims, "I always want a Happy Meal."
"Me too," I say to Joey. "I always want a Happy Meal too." I wait for Ben to reply, to join in on the momentary joy. He is lost again somewhere, gone for the moment, tucked into his head where he scurries more often now, where I have to reach further in to pull him back to me. "Ben," I say, "you want a Happy Meal too, right?"
"What?"
His eyes find mine.
"Oh, of course, buddy," Happy meals for happy campers.
Then he turns the radio back up, and we lose ourselves under the shadow of the Red Rock Mountains.
29. Ben. June 2002. Leo is his best self at his college graduation. Sober, shining, electric. After my dad, Leo's had his good days and his less good days. But he was a senior and allowed to get wasted and wake up with a wicked gut-churning hangover. So I didn't hover. And my mom was busy with a new charity, dedicated to raising funds for the families of 9/11 victims. So neither of us judged his bad days. Or, more accurately, neither of us was present enough to judge them. You could see them in bruises under his eyes, in his half-smile when recounting a memory of some stupid story or antic that he wasn't sure he was getting quite right because he couldn't remember it fully, or the way that he sometimes really needed a shower. But Leo was Leo, born with an impish streak, and he showed up at Sunday family dinners, a tradition Tatum had suggested in January when it was clear we all needed a bit of glue. Cogent, present, hilarious. He could make my mom drop her head back and cackle. And we didn't get that too often these days, so we let him go on being whoever he was. Today, he is the brightest star in a sea of blue gowns washing over Columbia campus. It's an overcast June day, sticky with threatening clouds, which is just as well. Every crisp spring and summer day reminds me of that crisp day in September. The air smells the same. The sun shines the same. And I'm happy for the gray skies whenever they present themselves. My leg is jittery, more out of habit than because I feel on edge. It started that day. A tick, I guess. Like my body is out of my mind's control. Tatum rests her palm on my thigh as if she can absorb some of its fire.
Well, this is a lot of pomp and circumstance, she whispers into my ear.
To be fair, no one really knew if he was going to graduate, I reply, and she laughs. And my mom glances over and smiles like she is glad we are laughing and not quite sure of the joke. She looks that way often these days.
No one made much of a fuss for me last week, Tatum says.
I did, I whisper back and kiss her forehead. She nods because she knows I did, in my own way. Tatum had her own graduation from Tisch just 8 days ago. She hadn't wanted a to-do, didn't invite her dad, didn't want Piper to spend the money on a plane ticket. I wondered if it wasn't about her mom not being there to celebrate, but she said,
I have to get used to celebrating a lot of things without her, Ben. I just want to get this over with, move to L.A., start our new lives.
She wasn't being a martyr or anything. She was just being practical, pragmatic. An oxymoron for an actress, but that was Tatum all the same. Able to compartmentalize her grief while also recognizing how much it shaped her, shifted her insides. So Leo and I sat through the graduation ceremony and whooped when her name was called, and afterward we went to the corner bistro and ate hamburgers. And then we boxed up her kitchenware and a few more items from her student apartment, and Leo jetted uptown. We were dusty and achy by the time we climbed into bed, and Tatum said,
This was perfect. I just want to get busy living life.
But she was jittery in the way that my leg was, figuratively staring at the horizon, awaiting whatever comes next. Tucking our respective blights behind us. Now Leo is called on stage to collect his diploma, and my mom weeps, though she would have wept with or without my dad here, so I ease my arm around her and squeeze her shoulder.
He would have been so proud of Leo, she says, wiping her nose with a tissue.
Yes, I say, because that's all I can manage. Leo has a job lined up after graduation as a trader at Merrill Lynch, exactly as my dad wanted. He starts in July, so he wants to come bum around California with us before his training, though I haven't acquiesced. It will be chaos, for one thing. The move, the unpacking, the settling down. I don't need my tornado of a brother there stirring up the winds. He tells me that he'll be on his best behavior, but I'd cleaned up enough of Leo's messes over the years. The pot in high school, phone calls to me at college to ask how to cajole money out of my mom or appease my dad's temper. When Leo had been busted again for drinking at some kid's house. The summer camp he got kicked out of, after my parents tired of him starting figurative and literal fires at the house in Vermont. To know that, while Leo might promise the moon, he'll often never even glance up at the sky. And my dad wouldn't want me to let him off the hook with all his shit. Wouldn't want him to come out to L.A. and sleep with beautiful women and drink too many vodka shots and act like he could be careless and not face consequences. I was never careless, because it was clear to me that carelessness was unacceptable. Leo nearly always was, because he didn't care how angry it made my dad. Also, I'll be busy. Too busy to entertain him. Actually, to mind him, since Leo always manages to plant his nose in trouble. He's grown now, and it's not my job to keep him out of it, but I also don't need him sleeping on my couch while stirring it up, either. Romantica propelled me into studio meetings, executive handshakes. I've already finished the working draft of my next script, All the Men, and it's been greenlit in a hurry to capitalize on the hottest, latest thing bursting on the Hollywood scene. We shoot in September, which means there is a frantic rush for rewrites, tweaks, notes from the studio that aren't smart or particularly savvy, but which I have learned to say yes to because arguing only sucks up time and energy that I don't have, between Tatum and Leo and my dad. It's exhilarating, this validation. It's moving so furiously that I can barely process it, and all the trappings of Hollywood's approval are not unwelcome. My father had long told me that being the best was the only goal to reach for, and now that I'm here, anointed and on top, I can understand exactly what he meant. Why he pushed me. The success feels addictive, like a high of a drug I've never taken, so I work harder, longer, more, chasing it even as it chases me. Also, we're getting married. There is a wedding to plan. I explain all of this to Tatum, that Leo in California will be one more thing I'll have to monitor, and I simply can't. My insides are dry and barren and a bit of a wasteland. I don't mind, she says. He can keep me company. I don't think you get it. Leo is a handful. He's not a toddler, she laughs. Worse, he's an adult with toddler instincts. Like, he's not potty trained? Like, hide the matches because he might burn the house down, I say. Besides, you'll be busy on your own, setting the town on fire. True, she says. True, I guess we'll just have to wear fire-retardant clothes at all times. Today, Leo wants to walk home from Columbia, though it's at least 2.5 miles to my mom's, and the clouds are drizzling thick, pregnant drops. A plane roars over us, too close, and I jolt, and he does too. But then it coasts past, and we shake our heads and keep going. You do that too? He says. I don't know how to get used to it. I think, with time. I hate this city, he says. Leo, we've had this discussion a million times. He has to work. He has a job. He needs to show up and be accountable. College is over. It's time to embrace real life. I know, he says, batting a hand. Don't start in with me. I know, okay? I can't quit on Merrill before I've even started. I get it. I'm a big kid now. Time to cut the purse chains. We amble in silence for a while after that, then stop in a bar, Westside Tavern, on Amsterdam Avenue. Leo primarily wants to get drunk, and that sounds like as good a plan as any. The place is mostly empty. A European soccer game is muted on the TV above the bar. We pull up stools, then I order 2 beers, then Leo says, also, 4 shots of tequila. Leo, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And your point is? I don't really have a point, so I do both shots and chase it with a beer. Maybe I'll just stay in California, he says, as he motions to the bartender for 2 more. I wave to the bartender to stop, to please cut me off. But he shrugs and slides the shot glasses our way. I can still be a grown-up in California. But he wants to surf in the mornings and sleep on our couch in the afternoons. He explains this when he's actually being honest, which we are about 2 shots away from. Don't you have a graduation party later? I shift the subject. Yeah, and? You're gonna show up wasted? Yeah, and? He laughs. God, when did you become dad? He stops laughing abruptly and both of us reach for the shots. Since the alternative is weeping or picking a fight or pounding our fists into the wall, which feels like it would help with the rage, but mostly also seems like it would just fill one form of pain with another. Drinking is the right solution. You can't skip out on your job, Leo, I say, as the tequila burns the back of my throat, the pulp of the lime fleshy on my tongue. Why not? Who gives a fuck? I guess I do. I say it as a question because it is, and also because I'm drunk. But mostly because I've never had to care one way or the other about my brother's irresponsibility. But now, with my dad gone, it occurs to me that I do. Ugh, he says. So you're the new Leo police. Come on, Dad never busted your ass the way he busted mine. He snorts. You were the prodigal son. Give me a break. Bust your ass, like you ever did that a day in your life. I pick up the rind of the lime and chew on it. I haven't eaten anything since breakfast, and I'm newly aware that I'm as hungry as I am inebriated. It's funny, I say. I think we both thought that. I always thought the same about you. That he was easier on you because you didn't give a shit. Leo gulps in too much air. I fucking miss him. He drops his forehead to the bar, and his shoulders start shaking, and it takes my woozy mind a moment to catch up and realize that he is crying. No. No, let's go punch a wall. Let's not feel this pain as we need to feel it. It's too acute. It will gut us, spill too much blood for us to recover. My dried-up insides can't bleed another ounce. I put a hand on his back until his jagged breathing becomes more steady, and then he wipes his nose on the sleeve of his gown, which is exactly what he'd do when he was little and my parents would make me babysit for him, and we'd watch TV while he wiped boogers on himself. Not so much has changed in the span of a decade or so, I realize. Leo still needs someone to look out for him, rub his back, wipe his nose. I ask for the check, and resolve right then that it will be me.
30. Tatum. July 2013. From Ben Livingston to Amanda Paulson, regarding things. Date, April 10th, 2013. A. Listen, God, this is probably the hardest thing I've ever written, but, well, you should know that I've been struggling lately. I just... Okay, here goes. I think we should probably take a break. I'm typing that, and it doesn't seem right, or maybe none of this seems real. I don't know. I'm so fucked up now, and I want you. You know how much I want you. But there are all these stories in the press now, and if Tatum finds out... I don't know what I want yet, and if this explodes before I've figured it out... Jesus, this is the most inarticulate thing I've ever written, and that's saying a lot. I want you. I need you. I just don't know what to do about it. What do you think? B. From Amanda Paulson to Ben Livingston regarding things. Date, April 10th, 2013. B. I understand. You know I do. But I do have to be honest and say that being with you again, well, it made me realize what an idiot I was back in New York, and if there's any way that I can keep you in my life, selfishly, I want that. I need that. I don't know how to undo this past year. I don't know how to turn this off. Does that sound overdramatic? I don't mean it to be. I only mean that you're so easy to love, and I can't help but feel like the only thing we've had wrong is our timing, our chronology. A. From Ben Livingston to Amanda Paulson regarding things. Date, April 10th, 2013. A. Wanna meet for a drink tonight at Sunset Tower and discuss? Maybe it will feel better if we do it in person. B. I am only on Ben's laptop because I forgot my charger in L.A., and Ben's is fully juiced and open and available, and Stephanie, my assistant, can't FedEx me the charger until tomorrow because FedEx doesn't make Sunday deliveries, and there is not an Apple store anywhere near Canton, and the electronics store at the mall is out of stock. So, all of this to say that I'm not even supposed to be on Ben's laptop. We're back home for Piper's baby shower, and I was looking forward to a weekend of just being Piper's big sister, not Tatum the movie star, not Tatum the great. Everything was so much more complicated now, with this big life up for public consumption. Ben has left his computer atop our bed when he went for a run, and it doesn't even occur to me that I shouldn't log on, that there is anything illicit to be found, that Ben might have a secret just as I do. Though a different one, of course. He has been writing again, sprawled all morning on the bed, pecking away, occasionally glancing toward me when I pop my head in and say, "How's it going?" and giving me a thumbs up. He's been exercising again. We've been making love from time to time. He's even willing to read a script or two for me when I'm deciding what to tackle for my winter projects. I'm in the thick of an HBO miniseries right now, a modern take on Agatha Christie. TV is suddenly hot, even for an Oscar winner. And then perhaps another directorial project, Love Runs Through It, to follow up Roe v. Wade, which I haven't even officially put to bed. I've been offered Broadway, but with Joey in school, I can't uproot him to New York, and who wants to be in New York for the winter anyway? Maybe over the summer. I proposed that to Ben. New York over the summer, and we can revisit all the old haunts? Do you think that Dive In is even still there? What about that cream puff store we used to love? He hesitated, said it depended on his own work, and I nodded and said, "Of course," and then chastised myself because I was trying to remind myself, or at least remind Ben, that my work didn't trump his, even when part of me thought that it did. Even when, intentionally or not, I did put my work first. I did forget him in my Oscar speech. Daisy had suggested that maybe he just felt emasculated. Maybe that was the reason for his funk. And I'd figured if I danced around my own successes, downplayed them enough, massaged his brilliance enough, I could reverse that. "You shouldn't have to apologize for your success," she'd said. "I mean, you haven't been perfect about all of it, but success? Nope. You can't begrudge yourself that." We were out power walking in the hills behind our house, my hat pulled low so no one would recognize me, her huge black sunglasses imploring someone to recognize her. My weight these days was a constant battle. You'd think that industry acclaim meant that 5 or 10 pounds was forgivable, but if anything, it only got worse. There was constant scrutiny, not just with the gossip on my life and the candids and the tabloids, but nearly everywhere I went now. Going out to dinner was a chore. There were eyeballs and stares, and inevitably, someone stopped by the table for an autograph. There'd been a stalker concern recently, a lanky oddball in his 20s who loitered outside the house and yelled lewd things at my car window every time I came and went. Finally, I hired security, who had him arrested. Dropping Joey at school was a dance with the other mothers, who pretended they hadn't just seen my face on some blog like Delisted, and I pretended that they weren't pretending. I was sized up in the line at Starbucks, sized up in wardrobe on sets. Even Luann, my publicist, would look me up and down and raise her eyebrows and say, "Darling, I love you, but no one loves a chubby girl." I almost fired her right then, but she just booked me the Vogue cover, which I needed to starve myself for anyway. "I'm not apologizing for my success," I said to Daisy between breaths. "I just think Ben's had a shitty time, you know, with Leo and his dad, all of that. I don't mean to sound like a bitch, but his dad was a decade ago, and the Oscar thing, 2 years ago." I didn't say anything about the Oscar thing. Ben never even mentioned it. "Listen, I get it. It's terrible. Terrible things happen all the time. When does he stop carrying that around? He's been so much better recently." I stopped and flopped over, touched my toes. "He's back on code emergency. He even went birdwatching with my dad last weekend." Daisy considers this. "Well, I gotta give anyone points who is willing to go birdwatching with anyone." I right myself, aim my arms toward the sky, arch my back, and groan. Then, softly, "I never told him about that night at Harbor. I mean, I never told him that Leo had relapsed." "So that's what this is about. This guilt, your apologies. Leo asked me not to, and Ben had been so unkind toward my dad, and I just wanted to prove Ben wrong, that people can get better and change. If Ben had known, I just felt like he would somehow be vindicated. Not that he wanted Leo to relapse, but just that, I don't know." I sigh, turn my face toward the breeze blowing in from the west. "I guess I was certain Leo would clean up. And then what harm did it do not telling Ben?" "You couldn't get Leo better any more than you can heal Ben," she says. "That's not your responsibility. You've gotten used to doing things your way, Tate, but this isn't one of those things. This was Leo's thing." "But what if it were my thing? What if it were Ben's, too?" I wanted to say, but she had already loped ahead of me. Today, in my old bedroom, in my own home, where I entertained plenty of what-ifs when my childhood took turn after turn, I wonder if Daisy wasn't right, and I wonder how I can possibly change, let go, if she is. In fact, I'd opened Ben's laptop to search his email for Dr. Paulson's follow-up report on how long Joey might have residual arm pain. He'd stumbled on a rock and fallen in my mom's garden and was whining about his wrist now. Piper had assured me that he was fine. She's a nurse, after all. But I couldn't take her advice. I had to solve it for myself. But I don't find that email. What I find is something so unexpected that it's literally as if my heart is seizing. I read and reread the email, then all of the emails with the name Paulson that litter his deleted files folder. They date back to last May. And that's when I fit the puzzle pieces together. Ben didn't even tell me she was that Amanda. Not at the hospital, not after. I check and recheck the dates of the exchange when he says he wants to end it. 3 months ago. Where was I 3 months ago? I scroll through the calendar on my phone because I need a calendar on my phone to keep track of my life now. At Legoland. At goddamn Legoland for the evening with the crew of America, a reward for those grueling night shoots, for enduring the lecherous looks of the director, Ronnie Slater, who liked to finish a take by yelling something like, "That was so good that my dick got hard just watching," or, "Tatum, you're so fucking hot that it's all I can do not to beat off right here behind the monitor." I told Ben that the event was just for cast and crew. Spouses weren't coming. But that wasn't true. A handful of wives and husbands caravanned down with us to San Diego for the festivities. But I had lied to Ben because it was the easier thing to do. Tote him along, watch him fumble with small talk, worry if he was having fun, worry if I were giving him enough attention. I just wanted this to be mine, as small and as insignificant as one stupid night at Legoland was. It occurs to me that I probably just could have said that. "Do you mind if I do this last thing with the crew without you? You can come, but would it be okay if I went on my own?" Ben has never begrudged me my independence, because he knew I'd show up when he needed me, and he probably would have just shrugged and said, "Sure." He hated theme parks anyway. And yet I lied. Maybe to be a little spiteful. Maybe because he'd been distant enough that it was a test, to see if he'd notice, to see if he was paying close enough attention. I close his email quickly, and then I race to the bathroom, where I spent hours examining my face as a teenager, trying to line my eyes just so to make them alluring, trying to scrub my skin so it shined like those Noxzema ads I saw. I heave over the toilet, purging what little I'd allowed myself for breakfast. A wisp of a memory makes its way in as I ease down to the floor, trying to catch my breath. IHOP. The endless silver dollar pancakes and the look of surprise on Julie Seymour's face when she recognized me. Back here, so many years ago. God, we'd been so happy then. How do you go from there to here? How does one moment in a lifetime of moments completely detonate the foundation you'd rested your existence on? Not that we hadn't been better recently. We had been. He was writing more. I was around more often. We had dinners with Joey, and sometimes evening walks, too. We weren't all sharp edges about my dad, or misinterpreted words about his career, or my time commitments, or whatever it was that we found to argue about. I hear Ben in the bedroom, and shut the bathroom door quickly with my foot.
"Tate," he calls. "Back from my run."
"Okay."
"I was gonna shower. You almost done in there?"
"Almost," I say. If this had been years back, if this had been IHOP, when we were so hot for each other that we screwed in the rental car's back seat in the grocery store parking lot like I had in high school, a random moment in time that had granted us Joey, I'd have ushered him into the bathroom with me, slipped into the shower with him to feel his skin pressed against mine. Now, I try to slow my racing heart and say, "Give me another minute, then I'll be done." I pull myself up. Meet my own eyes in the mirror that has reflected my face back a million times and tell myself that I already harbor one secret. Maybe if I keep this to myself, I can make it right. I can fix it on my own. We were doing better now. Who we used to be half a decade ago at that IHOP didn't feel so far, too far in the distance that we couldn't get it back. Ben was coming back to me, or maybe I was moving back to him, but we were starting to see each other again in ways that were ephemeral, but tangible too. Or maybe that was me misreading the script. Still, I'm not going to abandon us yet, not when I can envision how we can get it all back. So yes, I will tuck this away, right the ship, bring Ben back to me, bring me back to Ben. This is just one more secret between us, one more role I will myself to play.
31. Ben. September 2001. The only reason I'm awake is because Tatum had an early class and set off the fire alarm when she tried to fry bacon before leaving. Shit, oh, sorry, she said, scrambling around her tiny studio, flopping an oven mitt toward the smoke, batting down the alarm with a broom handle. The plastic cover popped off and crashed to the floor, where it promptly split in two. Tatum jumped like she hadn't expected that, for gravity to work, and then her apartment was silent again, other than the sizzle of the torched bacon. Shit, she said again. Go back to sleep. I didn't mean to wake you. I'd been up too late in the edit bay, splicing together the final cut of Romantica before I sent it out to the festival world, praying someone will take notice and give me my shot. It's fine, I said, rubbing my eyes, waving her closer. I promised Tom I'd read two manuscripts today anyway. You're seriously the best assistant agent he could hope for. Two books in a day? She shook her head and kissed me, hovering over the bed so her tank top fell low and offered me a view. Now how am I supposed to concentrate with that on my mind? She straightened and laughed, low and husky, and I leaned back against her headboard, my arms folded behind my head, and matched her grin. The first 2 months since her mom died were a spiral of gray, everything muted, everything numb. She kissed me because she loved me, and she sometimes, not as often as before, slept with me because that's what you do. But she wasn't here. She didn't eat enough, and she nearly got fired from the bar because she kept mouthing off to customers. But slowly, she'd come back. I didn't know if she would, though I never dared say that. Those words were never worth the damage they would have inflicted. I'd give her space, and she'd tell me I didn't care. I'd try to talk to her, and she'd tell me I was hovering. Then she'd cry and say it wasn't me, it was her fucking grief, and that I was the best thing about her life, and to please forgive her for being such a bitch. And of course I was going to forgive her for that. I didn't understand it, though. Her moodiness. Her push-pull. Daisy explained that all actresses, herself included, are basically nuts, so get used to it. But that was too easy to pat an explanation. So Daisy said that Tatum must trust me in order to show me all her ugliness, to not try to dress up her grief into something rosier or shinier or easier. And then I understood. She was letting me inside her, and for me to stand by her, to sit with her, was enough. But now she's coming back to me. Her classes help, I know. The structure of having a planned day, the lightness of becoming someone else for a few hours, someone whose mom hadn't died, someone whose dad wasn't a fucking mess. And time, too, though it had been only 3 months. This morning she said, if you keep this in mind long enough, I'll be back from class, and then... Then what? I laughed. Then it will just be your lucky day, I guess, she said, her hand on the front door. Then she was gone. By the time I shower and scrub the burned pot she'd abandoned on the stove, it's nearly 9 a.m. Her coffee maker is broken, like many other things in the apartment. So I slide on my flip-flops, thump down the building's concrete stairwell to the cart on the corner. It's a perfect, cloudless September day. Crisp breezes, powder blue skies. As if this is our reward for suffering through the sweltering days of August. It does kind of feel like my lucky day, actually. My editing session had gone well. I'm getting paid by a top literary agent to read early manuscripts. My girlfriend is smiling again and wants to screw me tonight. I pay for the coffee, slide my headphones into my ears, and decide to take a walk. Stretch my legs, enjoy the fall air. The caffeine electrifies my blood, and I resolve to do this every day, Self, I say, do this every day. Rise early. Kiss your sexy girlfriend goodbye. Start the day with some exercise to pump some energy into your veins. You are young. You are virile. It's going to be your goddamn lucky day. Three police cars race by me so quickly that I can literally feel the wind off their wake. Two fire engines roar to life behind me, flying around the corner, startling a woman next to me such that she jumps and slaps her hand to her heart. I fiddle with my Walkman radio where the DJs are talking about a small plane that has hit the World Trade Center. I halt quickly at that, peer around to see if anyone else is hearing what I'm hearing. But the morning rush hour keeps passing by. A Cessna, they're saying. Must have been a total fluke. I adjust my headphones and start up again. My dad works in the World Trade Center. But what are the odds? These guys probably don't even have it right. A small plane hitting a building. I shake my head. That can't be. Through the foam of my earbuds, I can hear sirens suddenly burst from all corners of the city, and this time people around me do stop, their faces registering alarm, like we were all listening to the same radio stations and all thinking, bullshit. But now perhaps realizing that this is not a joke. Not at all funny. The DJ shout in my ear, there's another plane. Another plane has hit the towers. Folks, this appears not to be an accident. We can only speculate, of course. A woman stops next to me, her headphones plugged into her own radio, and grabs my arm. Holy shit, she says. Oh my god, I reply. Then, my dad. I turn and start running back to Tatum's apartment, my flip-flops not able to match my pace, and I stumble when all I want to do is move faster than I've ever moved in my life. I take the steps two by two, jiggle the shaking key in her lock, and flip on her TV, which, thank god, is working today. It isn't always. I grab the phone and dial my mom.
Benjamin, she says out of breath. He's not there. It's okay. He's on a flight today, going to San Francisco for a deposition.
I can feel myself uncurl, like the cells in my body have been magnetically bonded together and have been granted release. Jesus, Mom. Thank God.
I know, but those poor people,
she says, as I find CNN on the dial. The reality of the image is worse than I could have imagined, even when the DJs were shouting in their mics.
Oh, Ben, call waiting. Let me take this.
I can see a monstrous, foreboding plume of smoke rising from each tower, like a death knell, like the Black Plague. My dad's firm is on the 99th floor. I lean over and squint, trying to assess where the plane's hit, if I'd know anyone inside. The commentators are saying things like, intentional and terrorist, and they already have a reporter on the ground. There is debris flying and terrified New Yorkers running, and though the reporter is trying to stay calm, her voice is quavering and she is coughing into her elbow. Get out of there, I shout to the screen, as if I know her, as if she can hear me. Then I remember. Tatum. She's downtown in class, not too far from the towers. She doesn't have a cell phone because she is foolish and tells me she doesn't want another bill to pay. I call her beeper number. I call it again. I try Daisy, but they're not sharing a course load this semester. Daisy is focusing on stage, Tatum on film, and their schedules rarely overlap now. The CNN anchors press their fingers to their ears. We are hearing that these were not small planes, one of them says. They were major airliners. We are talking about a possible hijacking situation. I feel my stomach rise to my throat, my pulse quickening in my neck. My dad is on a major airliner. No. No, 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 no. I just spoke to my mom and she said he was fine. I call Tatum's paging service again. Where is she? I rise and open the front door, poke my head out, looking for, I don't know, someone? Tatum? A neighbor? To confirm that this is real? This is actually happening and I'm not completely losing my shit? I should call Leo. I close the door. I should call Leo, and he will tell me that I'm being overdramatic and paranoid, because Leo is never overdramatic and paranoid, and he'll make me laugh because I'm such a worrywart of a baby. I'll probably wake him, fucking college students and their ability to sleep until noon. But I'd promise my dad over the weekend that I'd call him anyway, have a heart-to-heart about his future, try to get his head on straight. He's barely pulling C's, B's if he's lucky, my dad said. Forget about the LSAT. A decent law school. That's just Leo, I replied. Don't worry. I'm trying to get him an interview on the trading floor at Merrill, he sighed. Calling in some favors. He needs to have a plan. He's graduating in 9 months. Can't live on our dime forever. No law school at all? I asked. My dad always wanted him to come on board his firm, especially when it became clear that I wouldn't. Maybe a year or two as a trader, then he can transition. He needs to grow up, Ben. I could picture my dad shaking his head like he couldn't imagine how Leo had gotten this far in life without being drafted into clown school. He's all right, Dad. He was silent for a beat. Yeah, I know, he said finally. Of course I know that. He didn't sound like he did, though. I know I push you hard, Ben, and I know you don't always appreciate it. I laughed, but not really in a joyful way. Anyway, you're making something of yourself, he said. That's why I do it. And now it's time for your brother to do the same. He slid by for too long. It's because he's so fucking charming, I said. My dad laughed at that, but this time with true glee, because it was the truth. I grab the phone now, sink back onto the couch. Just as I start to punch in Leo's number, the CNN reporter starts shouting, running. Then a black cloud like nothing I have ever seen rushes toward the camera and overwhelms it. I drop the phone, cover my mouth, let out a scream that bounces off Tatum's small studio walls. No! The first tower falls, crumbling like a fragile set of pickup sticks. I sit there, paralyzed, completely disbelieving what my brain is attempting to register. Tatum. I need Tatum so very much right now. The door unlatches behind me and she steps over the threshold as if she could hear my spirit calling out. Jesus, she says, which comes out more like a wail. Jesus, she says again, this time crying for real. The phone rings on the couch where I'd left it. I look at her. She looks at me. I don't know who it is, I say. I'd only been trying to reach you. I free it from the cradle.
Ben,
my mom shrieks.
Ben, it was his plane. It was his flight.
What? I say, my mouth dry, my stomach already lurching through my throat. What?
Your dad!
She screams, a piercing pitch that I'll dream about for years into the future. She breaks down into unintelligible sobs.
He was here this morning, and now he's gone.
Tatum. November 2014. Ben wants to spend the day at the beach, Leo's favorite spot, a little north of the lifeguard stand that's just below the drop-off of the cliff near our very first place together, that one-bedroom bungalow on Ocean Avenue. It's a Thursday, so Joey is at school, and I'm due in the edit bay in the afternoon, tweaking and honing the footage we shot in September and October for Love Runs Through, my second directorial feature. Directing means endless hours of prep, of hand-holding, of decision-making, of administration, of imagination. It distracts me from Ben and Joe, and I know it makes me less of a partner, but the studio offered and I couldn't say no. Didn't want to say no. I accepted as soon as they called, on the call, in fact. Only later that night, when I shared it with Ben, uncorking a bottle of Bordeaux that the agency sent over, did I realize I'd said yes before asking him. He paused, and his jaw flexed in a way that signaled his displeasure, but he raised his glass all the same and said,
"To Tatum, who always said she would light the world on fire."
He waited until the next morning to ask me how, logistically, this was all going to work, that he knew, and thought I did too, that directing again was going to turn our schedule on its head, and that he didn't think it was too much to consult him first. He was right. Of course he was right, and I was stupid and impulsive and selfish and caught up in the moment with the offer. But part of me was also still angry about the affair with Amanda, though it had been a year, and I checked his emails from time to time, and it really did seem to be over. And yet, I bruised him in ways that I knew I could, when I could. "I'm sorry," I said.
"This isn't the sort of decision you get to make unilaterally."
"I know." I thought of Amanda, and how he had made that decision unilaterally, without me.
"Directing is such a bigger commitment than acting, Tate, and I'm working now, too."
On Code Emergency, which he doesn't care about, not in the way I care about making an impact as a female director in a male-driven industry. This was an unkind thought, truly unkind, and I blinked, literally blinked, to usher it away. "I'm sorry," I said, and moved to him. I got caught up in the moment, and I screwed up. But today, I have my mourning, something that I've tried to hold sacred even as the days and years mounted into chaos. Just like all those years ago when Joey was a baby and I was shooting nights or rushing to a fitting or an audition or a meeting to charm a director into giving me a part, I still did the mornings. Breakfast with Joe, then, when the paparazzi aren't swarming outside the driveway, a drop-off at school. I hadn't forgotten it was Leo's birthday, and I hadn't forgotten that this was Ben's ritual, and I wanted to be there to support him, show up. That's what he always needed from me. And I'd failed him in ways both big and small, but we're trying again, because if I dig through our chaos, I find that I still love him, want to keep building a life with him. Love, at this stage of marriage, is less concrete, more routine. Not the heady stuff of constant humping and platitudes. It's a pulse inside of me that quickens if I think of being without him. Not day to day, but in the grand scope. Of passing Joey off on weekends, of returning to an empty house, of not sharing my joy of landing a gig, of not reading the drafts of his work. And Ben seems happier, too. Like sleeping with Amanda exercised his anger at all the ways his life had diverted from his plan. I'd made a concession to myself that if this is the worst of our betrayals of each other, I could live with it. I'd betrayed Ben in my own way, too, by accepting jobs without considering his needs, by stowing the secret of Leo's relapse, by contemplating, albeit briefly, leaving him without ever confronting him about Amanda. I already know why he did it. I understand probably better than most, given my profession, given my rocky teen years with my mother's cancer. I understand how healing it can be to slip into another life, another reality, and Ben slipped into his by screwing Amanda. Piper, whom I told at her baby shower when she caught me crying in the bathroom, couldn't forgive him. Daisy, whom I told when we landed back in L.A., suggested that I ride it out, wait for Ben to return to me. "No one can get through life without vices," she'd said, as if that made perfect sense, which, to me, it had. "So don't confront him," I'd said. "I'm not married, Tate. I don't know what line I'd draw." I thought about that long afterward, the lines we all draw in all of our relationships, not just our marriages. How I'd drawn a firm line with my dad, and how we'd redrawn it over the years, expanding our boundaries until the original line had all but disappeared. How I'd drawn firm lines with my career, and how I'd had to redraw plenty of those, too. Flirting with scummy directors for parts, appearing on shitty TV shows just to launch myself out of P.F. Chang's. How my mother had drawn and redrawn her line with my father until she finally ran out of ink. Who's to say that my own pen had to be dry simply for Ben's one indiscretion? Who's to say that my own line with Ben wasn't pliable, too? I hadn't screwed around with anyone on set, but I hadn't confessed about Leo, and I hadn't explained why I'd pressed Ben for a second baby, though we'd been unable to conceive. I said it was because Piper's ebullience at her shower was infectious, that I wouldn't mind some downtime as a family. But it had really been because of Amanda, because I thought that another baby could bring Ben back to me. So it wasn't like I hadn't shifted my own lines. It wasn't like they weren't plenty malleable, too. Today, I let Ben drive because the photographers don't follow his car like they always do mine, and we find a spot not too far from the steps that cross the Pacific Coast Highway and take us right to the sand's edge.
"I just like coming here to remember him," he says. "I want to do it every year."
"Okay," I say. "We will." I think I like the sound of that. Every year. Our future. He hands me his keys, then his phone, and strides ahead of me and reaches the water first. The waves are choppy and bleak, uninviting, which is maybe how it should be, though I think Leo, who was brighter than the shiniest star in the galaxy, would want it some other way. Ben wades in to his ankles, to his knees, then all the way to his chest. Everyone else out here is in a wetsuit, if they're brave enough to venture in at all.
"Ben!"
I shout, though I can hear my voice dissipate in the whoosh of the sea winds. Ben, come on! He arcs his hands above his head and dives under. If he hears me, he doesn't flinch. I let him sink for as long as he needs to. He'll return to me when he's ready. He's been out there for 15 minutes and must be half frozen when his phone buzzes. On instinct, I glance at the screen. Not because I mean to, not because I'm snooping. It simply vibrates in my palm and I uncurl my hand and there it is. Thinking of you today. Then, I'm here if you need me. Blood floods my heart, and everything speeds up. The rush of the waves, the sound of the ocean, the footsteps of the jogger behind me, the sway of the palm trees that lurch as I spin around and race to the concrete boardwalk, which may provide surer footing. It can only be one person. This can only mean one thing. I fold myself in half, trying to abort the crest of nausea, the dizziness in my brain. Ben didn't come back to me like I thought. I inhale and exhale and try to stop the vertigo. I right myself and draw a line in the sand with my toe, and then I kick it away, gently at first, then angrily, furiously. When I calm myself, I'm surprised to discover that, upon further examination, there is no trace of the line at all. He heads straight to a warm shower when we get home. Into the cavernous white bathroom that is just off our cavernous white bedroom of the new house we moved into 3 months ago that was supposed to be our enclave, our safe haven to protect me from that stalker and from the rest of the outside world, too. I sit outside the closed door in the nook where he usually writes. His laptop is open, and I consider checking to see what he's been drafting, if he ever got around to writing that bullshit script for me, if he ever even was honest about that. But instead, I simply sit, and I wait. If I don't say anything now, even on Leo's birthday, I worry that it will get swallowed up like Ben might have underneath the waves today. I curl my hands into balls, a familiar release from way back when, from my mom and Aaron and my drunk dad and all the failed auditions and paltry tips at P.F. Chang's and everything in between, and I squeeze my eyes shut just as tightly. I can become anyone I need to be, just like I do in front of the camera, though my pulse beats loudly in my neck and a thin film of sweat forms underneath my armpits in the crooks of my elbows. Despite my expertise, however, I find I cannot become a woman hiding all these secrets any longer. He stays in the shower for minutes on end, and it's gotten so late that I nearly run out of time. I won't be late for the edit bay. My work won't suffer for this. It never has. It simply won't. I will tell him. I will compartmentalize this. And then I will go about my day because that is what I've trained myself to do. Shit! Ben yelps when he opens the bathroom door and sees me on the love seat. An oversized white towel is knotted around his waist. He's still in shape for 40, still built like he was a decade ago, though everything beneath that exterior has changed. It's a startling realization for me. Every actress constructs her career on matching her insides to her outsides. Play a kind prostitute and you wear trashy makeup. Ask wardrobe for an extra push-up bra. Ensure that your pink manicure is chipping, which might make viewers empathize with your heart of gold. Play a hardened lieutenant, but still loving mom and army women, and you train your body until fat is down to 8%, and you dangle a gold necklace with your kid's initials atop your army fatigues. What we see is always telling a story, until one day you realize that it's not.
Sorry, shit.
Ben holds up a hand.
You just startled me.
I know about Amanda. I say quickly, tersely, like it is just another fact that belongs to someone else's life.
What?
I know about her. I stand. I have since Piper's shower, back in Ohio. She texted you today, and well, my hands find my hips. I thought you should know.
I don't...
He opens his mouth, then closes it.
It's over. I mean, it's been over since...
He shakes his head.
It's been over since May. Don't lie to me after all of this, Ben. Please, just don't. Ben sinks onto the love seat, the towel splitting into a V atop his legs. He drops his head in his hands. No, I'm not. He raises his head, his tearful eyes finding mine. Sometimes she texts me. That's it. It's over, Tate.